Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, faucets, vanities, doors, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online now through July 18th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
The jury. Was the rent-a-car vehicle ever searched?
I do not believe so, but I'm not certain.
All right. Question form number 12. If the defendant and her daughter were interviewed as witnesses, why were they left with a victim advocate? In other words, were they considered victims or witnesses?
So our victim services section, I introduced Lori to them specifically because there are civilian employees that work within our police department that can help families with death investigations for the issues that come up afterwards and kind of navigating that process. So although they might not be classified under like state law as victims, our victim services section will often help our families with like specific crisis type events and navigating that process. So we use them quite a bit in our death investigations.
All right, on question form number 13, did Lori express concerns about police talking with Ty Lee at the time of the interview?
She did not.
Does law enforcement have to advise interviewees they are being audio and or video recorded?
They do not. There is no expectation of privacy within a police station.
All right. Are there any further juror questions at this time? Not seeing any. Would the defendant like to follow up on those juror questions?
No, Your Honor.
State?
Just briefly. With regards to introducing Lori entirely to your victim services, were you trying to provide whatever services might be necessary due to the fact that her husband had been killed?
Correct.
And what you assumed at that point was Tylee's dad or stepdad had been killed?
Correct.
And again, this is all prior to you learning more about this case?
Correct.
No other questions, Your Honor.
All right, you can step down. The state can call its next witness.
Thank you. State calls Detective Ariel Werther. I may need get some. There'll be a PowerPoint that he's going to do.
All right, sir, come on up. You're going to stand right here and be sworn in.
Can you spell your name?
Yes.
Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, Werther, W-E-R-T-H-E-R.
If you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Thank you.
All right, have a seat up here to my left. I do need to give the court reporter a break soon. Do you want? Should we just do that now?
This might be a good time rounder, just so I can get this set up and hooked.
All right.
To.
Why don't we have the jury go to the jury room for a short break? Please
call
remember.
All right, for the jury.
Please be seated. The jury's no longer need to complete the record. We did a sidebar this morning at 10:42 a.m. At that sidebar, the defendant indicated she wanted to question the witness further regarding how many times the witness had observed her and her demeanor, which would necessitate the witness talking about observing her here in this trial, observing her on July 11th of 2019, as well as the trial in Idaho, and possible viewing of interviews or social media posts. I advise the defendant that this is probably not a door she wants to open because the setting of those interviews would be relevant. For example, someone appearing in court intuitively might behave better than someone who's not appearing in court or in a trial. And the defendant said she would move on from that area. Is that an accurate recitation of the sidebar from the state's perspective?
Yes, Your Honor.
From the defendant's perspective?
Yes, Your Honor. That's fine.
All right. And then we did another sidebar regarding jury questions at 11:01 a.m. The first question, juror question number 10, as a detective, does your subconscious mind use a witness demeanor as any type of evidence? The parties agreed with me that that's probably not an appropriate question to ask, so it was not asked. Juror form question number 11 was asked. That was the question as to whether the rental car was ever searched. Juror question 12 was also asked by agreement of the parties. And this was the question if the defendant and her daughter were interviewed as witnesses, and the explanation between being interviewed or considered a victim versus a witness, which the witness answered. Question form 13 had four questions on it. The first question was not asked. Did Lori ever ask for an attorney during interviews of her and Ty Lee? The second question, did Lori express concerns about police talking with Ty Lee at the time of the interview? Neither side objected to that question, so it was asked. Question number three on Form 13, do police need parental consent to speak with a minor even if being treated as a witness, which the answer really is it depends, but it calls for a legal conclusion too for that witness. The state objected to it, the defendant did not. I didn't think it would be helpful with the jury in deciding any issue that's at fact in this case, so it did not, it was not asked. And then the fourth question on that form number 13, does law enforcement have to advise interviewees they are being audio and video recorded? Neither side objected to that, and that question was asked. Is that an accurate representation of the sidebar we had at 1101?
Yes, Your Honor.
From the defense perspective?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so let's give the court reporter a break. We'll resume soon, probably about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then we'll push through to noon or maybe a few minutes after, depending on where we're at. Do you have your everything set up now?
I would like to just try to make sure it's working.
All right, we'll be at recess on a break for about 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah.
All right, let's bring the jury in. The jury is present. Please be seated. Go ahead.
Thank you. Would you please introduce yourself to the jury?
Hello, my name is Ariel Werther, and I work for the Chandler Police Department as a detective.
How long have you worked for the Chandler Police Department?
I've worked for Chandler Police Department since 2008. I did not become a sworn law enforcement officer until 2011. I've worked for them continuously since then. They are the only law enforcement agency I've ever worked for.
Can you tell us sort of the different areas you have worked and where you currently work?
So initially from 2008 to 2010, I was a police dispatcher. So if you called 911, I might be the person who answered, or I might be the person sending the officers and keeping track of where they were. And then in 2010, I went to the Arizona Law Enforcement Academy, graduating in 2011 as a sworn officer, returning to Chandler in the capacity as an officer. I worked as a patrol officer until, well, technically 2016, but the last 2 years of that I was assigned as a field training officer, which means that if you were a new officer out of the academy or somebody going back to the road from a specialty, you might ride with me for a while as I reoriented you to how things are done on the road. And then after doing that, I moved to the Special Victims Unit, primarily focused on investigating sex crimes from 2016 to 2020. And in 2020 and until now, I've been assigned to the Robbery Homicide Unit.
When you were with the Special Victims Unit, did you ever work with the Robbery Homicide Unit?
I did. In fact, from fairly early on, I was aware that this was something that I wanted to do eventually. So I made that known, and particularly working in detectives in under the umbrella of persons crimes, you have your sex crimes, family crimes, robbery homicide units, and they all tend to work rather close together. They get to know one another, and I made it known that I had an interest in testing when they had their next opening. So I did that in late 2019 and began my assignment in 2020. So leading up to that, it was something where if I had the opportunity to work with that team, I would do so.
Can you talk to us, have you ever had any type of training in dealing with cell phones and cell phone GPS data?
Yes, I've had extensive training, much of it more recently. It's something that I certainly became aware of, and I have an interest in technology and what it can be used for in investigations. And so there were areas that I was aware of, particularly working in the Special Victims Unit, so starting from about 2016 on. It was in 2022 that I took my first 40-hour class on the proper interpretation, pardon me, of cell phone records specifically that might come from the provider. There's an important distinction between the location data that might be found on one's phone versus the data that a provider stores about our devices that can also be used to infer the location of the device. I took a 40-hour class primarily on that subject in 2022, And then in 2023, I took a 40-hour class leading to eventually becoming a subject matter expert in that area.
Have you previously testified in court about cell phone GPS data?
I have.
Have you previously testified in court about mapping GPS data recovered from cell phones?
I have.
In July of 2019, were you still in the Special Victims Unit?
Yes, I was.
And did you become involved in a shooting that occurred on July 11th of 2019 at 5531 South Four Peaks Avenue in Chandler?
I did.
How did you get involved in that?
I believe I was downstairs where we all work in a similar area and became aware that a shooting had occurred, that it appeared that one person was deceased, and I volunteered to come along. My capacity was more to shadow, to learn about how these investigations are conducted with the aim of testing. That's something that's best practice to do if you want to test for a unit. You ought to go out and see how the job is done.
So when you initially, did you go out to the scene?
I did.
And when you initially out there, who did you shadow at first?
Initially, I was at the scene with Detective Coons. I was present during the scene investigation, though again, as someone who was observing, I didn't personally impound anything or directly conduct the scene investigation myself.
Okay. At some point, as you are shadowing these, were you given different requests to help the detectives who are working this case?
Yes, although I'd say the extent to which I started going out and doing things, assigned tasks, really began the day after, on Friday the 12th.
So on Friday, July 12th of 2019, did you become aware that no one had obtained contact information for J.J. Vallow?
That's right.
And did you offer to reach out to Lori Vallow to get that information?
I did.
Why did you need that information?
To have a complete and thorough police report, it's best practice to have proper documentation, name, date of birth, basic demographic information for all the people who are involved in a case, however they might be involved. Given the information we had at that time, he's someone who ought to be listed in the report.
Okay. Was he also known to be the son of the deceased victim?
Yes, that's right.
On the 11th, had you had any contact with Lori Vallow?
I did not have any contact on the 11th.
Okay. On July 12th, after you offered to get that contact information, did you make contact with Lori Vallow?
I did.
Did you see her or call her?
I called her at first.
And was that call recorded?
That call was audio recorded, yes.
When you spoke with Ms. Vallow, did you obtain the contact information for J.J. Vallow?
Yes.
Did you learn from her where J.J. went to school?
Yes.
Did you confirm that she had gone to Burger King before taking J.J. to his school?
Yes.
Did you at some point during that conversation with Ms. Vallow learn that Charles Vallow was staying at the True Hilton Hotel?
Yes.
Prior to this, had you known that he was where he was staying?
I don't think I had any information either way.
Okay. So as someone who was separate, did you have any idea where Charles was, whether he was staying at the house or elsewhere prior to this?
I didn't have that information, no.
So you just learned this during your conversation when you're trying to get JJ's information?
Correct.
Did Ms. Vallow advise you that she was in possession of Charles Vallow's hotel room key?
She did.
Did she advise where she had found that?
In his wallet, I believe.
So you learned that she had Charles Vallow's wallet?
That's what she said.
And that she then had a room key for him to True Hilton Hotel?
Correct.
Did you advise her that you would talk to the case agent and let her know who would go get that?
Yes.
After you spoke with Lori Vallow on the phone, did you offer to go out to the Burger King to see if you could obtain any video from there?
I did.
And when you are helping in this aspect of the case, were you aware at that time when the 911 call had been placed?
I was.
And when was that?
That was at 8:36 in the morning.
So you knew as you went out to Burger King that the 911 call was July 11th, 2019 at 8:36 a.m.?
Yes, that's correct.
And were you aware when you went out to the Burger King of when the police had arrived at the scene?
Yes.
And was that within a few minutes around 8:41 or 8:42 a.m.?
Yes, that's about right.
And were you aware prior to going out there of when Lori Vallow had been shown or seen on body cam back at 5531 South Four Peaks?
I was.
And was that the 8:48 a.m.?
Yes, that's right.
So all of this is kind of the timeline you're considering when you're going out to Burger King?
Correct.
So when you went out there, were you aware of that, I guess when you went out to Burger King, were you also under an understanding that Lori Vallow had said she was at the house when Charles Vallow was shot?
That was my understanding, yes.
So did all of that play into when you would assume the timing of her arriving at Burger King?
It did.
So sometime after 8:36 is what you're expecting?
To some extent. I was aware that there's a little bit of a logistical difficulty in the question of how one could leave at 8:36 or at just after and then arrive back by 8:48, knowing the distances and knowing the city of Chandler like I do. So because of that, knowing that it was clearly the case that she was there at 8:48 because she was on officer's body-worn video, then I knew that there was some chance I would find that the video was in fact prior to the 911 call. Because otherwise, the distances and the travel didn't seem quite right.
So you see this 12-minute time from when 911 is called to when she arrives back, and you're thinking that there's no way to go to Burger King and drop a kid off at school and get back?
Correct. One of the other things that I was trying to establish when I called her is where she had taken him to school and to confirm that we hadn't misunderstood about the Burger King event happening after the shooting. Because if we hadn't misunderstood and then learning where the school's approximately 7 miles away from the house. So the idea that one could in 12 minutes go to a Burger King, get their order, drive 7 miles one way, 7 miles back, and arrive in that amount of time seemed very unlikely to me.
So you're now going to Burger King to try to figure out when she actually went there?
Correct.
When you are going to the Burger King, were you aware of what vehicle she was driving?
I was.
Was that, again, body cam had shown what vehicle she had come in?
That's correct.
And was that a red Kia Sorento?
That's right.
So when you, let me ask you this. Did you go to a Burger King over at 2865 East Ocotillo Road in Chandler?
I did.
How did you know to go to that one?
I chose that one because it was the closest one, and I wanted to make that logical assumption that that's probably where someone would go first and then see if I found evidence there that that was the correct one.
All right, so you weren't given that information. You're just trying to figure out which Burger King it was.
Correct.
Did you ask to see if they had surveillance video from the morning of July 11th?
I did.
So you're there on July 12th?
Yes.
When you look at surveillance video at a place like a Burger King, do you ever verify that the date timestamp on that video is accurate?
I do. We very commonly find that at various places, the level of accuracy to their date and timestamps can be exactly right, or they can be off by a significant margin. So the best practice and what I did in this case is I will ask to see their live view, and the live view typically has a timestamp as it did in this case, and then I will use my cell phone, my work cell phone's location time, or my work cell phone's time. And if they match up, then to me that indicates that the timestamp is probably relatively reliable, particularly if I'm there just the day after the video that I'm looking for.
In this case, was the date timestamp correct for that Burger King?
Yes, that's right.
Did you then ask to watch the surveillance video from that morning of July 11th?
I did.
And as you were watching it, did you see a red SUV and a person that appeared to be Lori Vallow going through the drive-thru?
I did.
Do you recall about what time you saw that happen?
I want to say the timestamp on that is around 7:20 something.
Is it 7:54?
7:54. That is probably correct, yes.
So if you're looking at a timestamp at 7:54 and you know the 911 call is at 8:36, are you already starting to wonder what's going on here?
Yes, this was one of the concerns that led us to pursue this avenue of investigation.
And you're aware that Lori Vallow had told Detective Inclan that she had left right after Charles was shot?
That is what I was told.
So if she left right after he was shot, she somehow is already at Burger King more than 40 minutes after the shooting, before the 911 call?
Correct.
Did you look at various channels from that surveillance video at Burger King?
I did.
And did you also ask to obtain a receipt from her purchase?
I did.
If I can have my paralegal approach with 217 and 218.
Thank you.
We're looking at 217 and 218. Do those contain affidavits from Burger King authenticating both the recording and the receipt?
They do.
And is that from the Burger King that you went to obtain that video and that receipt?
It is.
The state will move to admit 217 and 218.
Any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
217 and 218 are admitted.
Now, just so we know, although we have the video right there and that's been admitted, did you create a PowerPoint we're going to get to in a bit that actually includes the relevant portions of that video in it?
I did.
Okay. So ultimately, we have 7:54-ish that you see Lori Vallow going through the Burger King. Were you then ever asked to meet with Lori Vallow to get that hotel key, still on the 12th here?
Yes, that's correct.
Where did you meet with her?
I met with her at the Four Peaks house.
Okay. Do you recall meeting with her there around 2:10 in the afternoon on July 12th?
Yes, that's right.
Did she provide you with a key card to a hotel, or what looked like a key card to a hotel?
She did.
Do you see that person who gave you Charles Vallow's key card in the courtroom today?
I do.
And can you point her out and identify what she's wearing?
Yes. She's sitting at the defense table wearing a black blazer.
Your Honor, may the record reflect the witnesses identified the defendant.
It shall.
Now, at this time, you had already watched the Burger King video that we've discussed. Did she appear to be the same person you saw driving that red Kia Sorento?
Yes, that's correct.
And when you went to the residence at 5531 South Four Peaks, did you see a red Kia Sorento at that residence?
I did.
And did that have Colorado license plates of BRS 084?
It did.
Did that appear to match the vehicle you also saw going through the drive-thru of that Burger King?
It did.
When you got the key card, did you then meet up with Detective Moffitt to go to the hotel?
Correct.
And was that the True Hilton at 1950 South Santan Village Parkway in Gilbert?
Yes.
When you went there, were you able to verify that that's where Charles Vallow was staying?
Yes, I believe Detective Moffitt spoke to them, but then we were directed to a room.
So Were you present with Detective Moffitt during that?
I was present, yes.
Okay. And so you were provided with a room number where he was staying?
Yes.
And were you provided, well, you had a room key already to get in there?
Correct.
Did you, while you were there or later, obtain both an affidavit and record showing that Charles Vallow had stayed at that hotel?
Yes.
If I can have my paralegal approach with 219.
Thank you.
Does 219 contain an affidavit authenticating the reservation and room information for Charles Vallow at that True Hilton Hotel?
It does.
And that's the hotel you had gone to with the key card that you got from the defendant?
Yes, that's correct.
The state will move to admit, and I forget what number that is. Is that 219? Sorry.
This is 219.
State will move to admit 219.
Any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
219 is admitted.
And if I can publish that.
Go ahead.
We all know. Thank you. So, just pull out a little. We see this is from in Exhibit 219, the True Hilton at 1950 South Santan.
Yes.
And did this show that Charles Vallow arrived on the 10th and was supposed to leave on the 13th?
Yes, that's correct.
And then were you also provided with information that this was Charles Vallow's room?
Yes, that's right.
Did you and Detective Moffitt go into room 127?
We did.
And when you went in there, what was inside?
There were items that I understood to belong to Mr. Vallow. That was our primary reason for being there, was to secure them. A backpack, two suitcases, I believe, at least one laptop computer. I assisted in gathering these up and impounding them.
Okay. So all of those items were brought to the Chandler Police Department and impounded?
That's right.
Okay. After you had gone to the True Hilton Hotel, did you also learn that the defendant had told Detective Enclam that she had stopped at a Walgreens to buy some flip-flops?
Initially, I was told a CVS. Whether I misunderstood or there was a miscommunication, I initially believed it was a CVS.
So did you try to locate a CVS in the generic area that you're looking at of the Burger King and the school?
I did. I tried actually seven different CVS locations trying to locate video and wasn't able to.
So at that point, you were unable to verify that initially?
Correct.
Were you then asked to review the GPS data that was extracted from Charles Vallow's cell phone?
I was.
Did you have anything to do with extracting the data from his cell phone?
I did not.
Can you talk to us about this GPS data that's part of this extraction? Like, do all cell phones give us GPS data?
As an end user and the person who doesn't do the extraction, depending on a particular user's settings, particularly if we're talking about smartphones, phones equipped with a GPS module and where that GPS module is working, they may record the GPS location of the device for various reasons, depending on the settings. I, for example, keep my GPS location off, so you would not expect to find very many GPS recorded locations on my device. Many people keep them on. I find it's quite common. If so, then the people in the computer forensics unit are able to extract data from the phone to include logged GPS locations. and then can produce that in a report, which as an end user, I can view the latitude, longitude that was recorded by the device for one reason or another, and the date and time that it was recorded by the device. And that gives us GPS locations to look at for where the device may have been.
So for Charles Vallow's phone, were you, through that extraction, provided with, I'll call it ongoing GPS data location for his phone on July 11th?
Yes, so there were GPS locations recorded on the device for July 11th, which was the time period of interest, and I was able to look at those.
Okay, so whether, did you look and see if there were GPS location device information on the phone for other dates as well?
I did not do that.
You're just looking at the date of this shooting?
Correct.
And when we talk about the device, so this is telling you not who has the device, just where the device is.
That's right.
When you were looking at that GPS data from the extraction of Charles Vallow's phone, did you discover that Lori Vallow may have actually gone to a Walgreens?
I did.
Based upon looking at that information, did you find an address at 785 South Cooper Road that corresponded to a Walgreens where you saw the device at around 8:15 a.m. on July 11th?
I did.
Based upon seeing that GPS data, did you go to that Walgreens?
Yes, I initially called. I eventually went.
After going to 7 CVS, you decided to call?
I decided to call.
And when you called, did you learn that they did, in fact, well, what did you do? How did they know what you're even looking for?
I called, asked to speak to a manager, as I will often do in things like this, and said, I don't tell them specifically why, but I'm looking to see if a person came through, and I provide a general description of that person and what it is that they may have purchased. Usually, that's enough. That's what I did in this case. That's enough for them to find if they do or don't have that transaction on video. That's what I did.
So you have the time and the date, the 8:15 and July 11th, and you just give them a description and see if they can find anything that matches?
Correct.
Did they advise you they did?
They did.
Did you go to that Walgreens and obtain a copy of that surveillance footage?
I did.
From multiple cameras?
Correct.
Did you also obtain a copy of the receipt of her purchase?
I did.
My paralegal can approach with 216. And so looking at 216, do you see an affidavit for that Walgreens that you contacted regarding obtaining both the surveillance video and the receipt, as well as a copy of the receipt and the video itself?
I do.
Your Honor, the state will move to admit Exhibit 216.
Any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
216 is admitted.
And if I can publish the receipt portion. So for this receipt, it advises that at 8:19, there was a purchase for two different pairs of flip-flops.
Yes.
Okay. And that corresponded to what you observed on the video that is in this exhibit as well?
Yes, that's correct.
In watching this video, did you recognize the person making that purchase?
I did.
And who did you recognize that to be?
I recognized Ms. Lori Vallow at the time, now Ms. Daybell, from having seen the body-worn video and also having met her in person.
Okay. And the video that you obtained here, did you also incorporate that into a PowerPoint presentation that you created showing the GPS data location from July 11th of 2019?
I did.
Okay. When you, well, let me ask you. So did you create a PowerPoint presentation of the GPS data from Charles Vallow's cell phone for July 11th of 2019?
I did.
When you were creating this PowerPoint, did you use any phone records for other individuals such as Lori Vallow?
I did.
When you were creating this PowerPoint, did you utilize cell phone records, and I think you talked to us about the difference here, and cell tower data that was provided to you by the providers, and by providers I mean like a T-Mobile or an AT&T?
Those records were provided to Chandler Police Department, not to me directly. I later obtained copies that I used to incorporate in my presentation.
So were you aware of search warrants that were issued to obtain cell phone records to include cell tower data for several different individuals?
Yes.
So in your PowerPoint presentation, did you utilize GPS data that was for Lori Vallow's Verizon cell phone with a phone number of 808-755-5452?
One minor clarification. I wouldn't call it GPS data particularly. There's location
data,
correct, but not specifically derived via GPS, as was the data from Mr. Vallow's phone.
And if I can have Exhibit 222. In Exhibit 222, do we see both an affidavit authenticating Lori Vallow's Verizon cell phone records for that 808-755-5452?
We
thumb drive of all of the phone records?
Yes, it does.
And does it also include some printouts from those records themselves?
Yes, it does.
State will move to admit 222 into evidence.
Any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
222 is admitted.
Did you utilize then some of those, some of the cell tower data that was provided by Verizon in those records for Lori Vallow's cell phone in your PowerPoint presentation?
I did.
Did you also become aware of the police executing a search warrant for another cell phone associated to Lori Vallow with T-Mobile for 480-692-9562?
Yes.
Were you provided with those records so that you could also look at the cell tower usage of that phone on July 11th?
Yes.
If my paralegal can approach with 220. Looking at Exhibit 220, is there an affidavit in there from T-Mobile?
Yes, there is.
Related to, again, Lori Vallow, 480.
That's correct.
Does it also include a thumb drive of all the records in there?
It does.
As well as some of the records printed out?
Yes, it does.
The state will move to admit Exhibit 220.
Any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
220 is admitted.
If I can just do one more before we
go ahead.
Were you also made aware that search warrants were executed to obtain Verizon cell phone records for Alexander Cox for a phone number of 480-3. And did you utilize those records and the cell tower data that was part of them in your PowerPoint presentation for July 11th of 2019?
Yes.
And if I can have my paralegal approach with 221. Looking at 221, do you see an affidavit there from Verizon for the Verizon cell phone records for 480-310-9120?
I see an affidavit, but I see this is the number ending 5452. Okay.
And if you can look at the, is there a second affidavit in there?
Yes, this does include 9120, but I saw on the envelope here it lists the other number.
Perfect. So there's an affidavit in there for the 9120 number associated with Alexander Cox.
Yes.
And there's also a thumb drive in there of all the phone records associated with, again, that number 480-310-9120.
Yes.
And those were, again, records that you utilized in creating your PowerPoint for July 11th. The state will move to admit Exhibit 221.
Any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
221's admitted.
Now, you talked to us earlier about your training experience in using GPS data and cell tower data, correct?
Yes.
When you are looking at either GPS data from a cell phone or cell tower data from a provider, do you try to verify the accuracy of that information by comparing it to other sources?
Absolutely.
For instance, you told us that you were using the GPS data from Charles Vallow's cell phone and you went to Burger King.
Correct.
And were you looking at the times to see if the GPS data and time matched what you saw in that video?
Yes, with one slight correction. I went to the Burger King initially because it was the closest one. Later, when I was given the GPS data, I looked and saw that it did, in fact, accord to the Burger King. And then I went to the Walgreens because of what I had seen in the GPS data. In either direction that you do that in, essentially what I'm trying to do is make sure just because a device has logged a location at a particular date and time doesn't have to mean it was there. The device could be wrong. It could have been changed in some way. One of the things that we do to make sure that we are relying on good data only is to find other means of corroborating if the device was apparently at that location.
Thank you. So I have this plugged in here, if I can just admit it, but did you provide the state with Exhibit 209, that is a thumb drive of your PowerPoint presentation?
Yes.
Did you sign, and I think put your badge number on the back of it?
Yes, that's correct.
And that's something you created that we've talked about, incorporating all of these different records that we've discussed?
That's correct.
Your Honor, the state will move to admit Exhibit 209 into evidence.
Any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
209 is admitted.
Might be a good time to break before we start with this.
All right. Let's take our noon recess. I'll remind the jury of the admonition. We'll resume with the jury at 1:30 p.m.
All rise for the jury.
The prosecution is present. The defense is present. Jury is not present. Apparently, you have a witness issue this afternoon?
Yes, Your Honor. Detective Duncan was out ill yesterday and ill Sunday as well, and was not doing well as the morning went along. So I did send him home, and so Detective Werther will be our last witness today.
Okay.
I presume that Detective Duncan will be hopefully better tomorrow.
Right. All right, so depending on, well, when we finish with this witness, whether it's before or after our noon break, or afternoon break, we'll conclude for the day at that time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry about that.
Is there anything else that we need to discuss before we bring the jury in?
Not that the state's aware of.
No? Okay. Let's bring the jury in. Jury is now present. Everyone may be seated. You can continue with this witness.
Thank you. So, Detective, before the break, we had just admitted Exhibit 209, a PowerPoint that you created utilizing the GPS data that was extracted from Charles Vallow's phone, correct?
Yes.
The cell tower data that you obtained through, that you were able to obtain from search warrants on cell phones for Lori Vallow and Alex Cox.
Correct.
As well as incorporating some of the video that you had obtained from Burger King and the Walgreens.
That's right.
All right. We had attempted to see if you could control this from your location, but you were not able to, right?
Correct.
So I'm going to have you sort of tell me as we go through when to proceed to the next stop, okay?
Very good.
So on this first page, is this just describing for us the cell phones and the data, where you obtained the data from?
Correct.
Okay. Can you talk to us about what we're seeing here? What is this for?
Yes, so I try to have a slide for each set of records incorporated into the presentation. These are records I was provided. It's not necessarily the case that every one of these things is depicted at some point in the presentation, but these are all the records I was provided, about this number ending in 5452. Throughout the presentation, I'll refer to most of the numbers by the last four digits. It's just easier than listing the whole thing out, and they all have unique last four. So the listed subscribers is listed there, and then also the contact name that was listed in the subscriber records, and then you can see what each of the files was, primarily CSV or XLSX files. These are spreadsheets like you would open in Excel.
Okay. Next.
Yep. Okay, there we are. This is the same title for a different phone number ending 9562. You'll notice this one is T-Mobile, and the way T-Mobile provided their records is a lot fewer spreadsheets. It just happens to be the case that Verizon tends to provide an awful lot of files. It's just the way they maintain their records, and we don't control that.
So some of them have records that one spreadsheet may include everything from calls to cell tower locations, and others they separate them all out.
Correct. Different businesses choose to keep their records different ways. We don't dictate it. We take what we're given, and then we analyze that.
So this 9562 number is for Lori Bell.
That's what the subscriber information listed, yes. And here we have the records related to a Verizon number ending 9120, listed subscriber, Mr. Alex Cox. This is again Verizon, so as you can see, we have that multiple number of spreadsheets in the manner that they tend to provide them.
And those are sort of the things that were on those thumb drives when we were talking
Correct.
About the exhibit?
Correct. And then this is going to represent the data extracted from Mr. Vallow's phone after the fact. This report that I incorporates only the locations logged by the device. There's other data on the phone that I don't address here.
Okay. And then you referred to the evidence item of the CH131035-001.
Yes.
And that's impound number for that cell phone.
Yes, that's the Chandler PDSI number for that particular device from which the data was extracted. I mentioned some of this earlier, but again, I have it on the screen here representing that these are location data expressed as latitude-longitude pairs, as you would see in many other circumstances. Any given device may log them more frequently or less frequently, but we can examine the phone and see if they are present. And then for the data point marker, if you would click advance once, when it's represented on the screen, it's going to be represented as a dot with no particular radius because the way that the device stored the location, it provides a latitude and a longitude, but it doesn't make any assertion as to what the error rate on that is. It just says, here's the latitude and longitude that I, the device, recorded on this date at this time. As we go through and we're looking at location data inferred from cell site connections, you will see pins on the map and they're color-coded because one of the easier ways for people to tell which thing we're looking at is what color it is. So you saw in the last slide I had assigned the GPS location data the color of red. It's just as an arbitrary assignment. And then we have blue for one of the phone numbers attributed to Lori Vallow. We have purple for one of the other phone numbers attributed to Lori Vallow. We have green for the number attributed to Alex Cox. When you see these, those will be what they're associated with. And also, because that could be hard to remember, each slide that represents those records will have tabs up at the top to remind people of what they represent. We can advance, I think. This shape that you will see when we're dealing with cell site connections, this is a visual representation of what the estimated coverage area of a particular cell site would look like if you were above it looking down. So there's the way that the records are stored and the way that they're returned to us by the cell phone providers. They will indicate a date and a time a connection was made. They'll give sufficient information to identify the tower to which it connected and also the face of the tower. So cell phone towers have multiple faces that a device could connect to, and that's going to indicate a direction generally, and then one can estimate what the coverage area of that face of the tower might be, and that's represented on the map as an estimate of the device's likely location area.
So when we're talking about the cell phone itself giving you the GPS location, is that more specific than the cell tower data that you're receiving from the providers like Verizon and T-Mobile?
Yeah, so there's a distinction between precision and accuracy, right? So precision is how precisely the thing is defined. So what area? So when the GPS location data says this exact latitude and longitude to some number of decimal places was logged at this time, that's very precise. That doesn't mean it has to be very accurate, but it does mean it has to be, it's quite precise. What you will see when these devices are connecting to cell towers is you're going to see relatively large areas where the device is inferred to have been. It likely was in that area. This is different because the device didn't record this location. The provider recorded that on this date, at this time, this mobile device connected to this tower on this face, and we know or are able to determine the approximate coverage areas of those towers. But it's not more precise than that. It's a much more general area. This is another representation of that shape. So this shape is derived by people in the industry by testing the way that these antennas work in what's called an anechoic chamber, which is a fancy word for a room that's designed to reduce the interference with the propagation of radio waves. So if this represents what a coverage area might look like under lab conditions, one thing to keep in mind is that the real world basically never mirrors lab conditions. This is an estimated area where you would expect an antenna to likely have coverage. And that's what it's represented for. And then if you click forward, it just shows the direction the antenna face was pointing if you are looking at one of these shapes on the map, then that center line is what's known as the azimuth, which is essentially just the angle at which that face of the tower was recorded to have been facing.
So you're not able to tell us within this area where the cell phone may have been located?
Not without a different type of data or a separate corroboration. It's to say that the likely coverage area where the device likely was is somewhere in that red shaded area.
And so when you talked about trying to use other sources to verify this, we talked about Charles Vallow's phone and looking at the GPS data, for instance, with the Walgreens. Are you doing the same thing with the cell tower?
Yes, that's correct. It's with any of the data that we're given that asserts to represent the location of a person or of a device, one of the first things one wants to ask is, okay, well, how reliable is that? And what ways can we determine if it's reliable? And so in all instances, I'm looking to see other corroboration that that location data appears to be accurate. This is an example of what the mapping will look like that you'll see throughout this. So this is just a section taken from a slide that was generated, and I put it up front so you can see in advance what it's likely to look like at different points. So if you click forward, this is going to represent the, in Google Earth Pro, they have this timeline slider bar that allows one to interact with what time it is. So up top, that should be visible, and there will also be notation, and it'll show approximately when the events depicted on the screen took place, and it'll be a range. It can be widened or narrowed as needed. And if you'll click forward. So as we just discussed, the estimated location for the device ending 9120 would be somewhere in that green shaded area. And if you'll click forward, the iPhone, which was recording its locations as pinpoints, those are all expanded out, but you see how the lines all draw to the same approximate place. That means that for a period of time, it was in a same location, and when one clicks on it, they all balloon out to show that they're all tied back. Tied back to that same place. So you would expect the iPhone to be in the area where those all tie together. And if one zooms in, you know, you get a more precise look at that. And then if you click forward, then the estimated location for 5452, somewhere in the lavender shaded area. You'll notice that they're sized differently. This size is an estimate based on cell phone tower density. It can vary by provider, and it can vary by the area, because as a general rule, cell phones seek the strongest connection that they have available to them. So when the device connects to the tower, that tower's area may be greater if there is less density of cell towers around, and it may be smaller if there's more density. And then the last thing is a reminder of what those tabs up top are for. Those are just to help a viewer keep track of what they're seeing on the screen.
All right. You told us that you mapped just July 11th of 2019, correct?
Correct. So this animation is showing location data derived from the cell phone. So you'll see the tab up top reminding you what the color coding means. And it shows the True by Hilton 1950 South Santan Village Parkway. And that the location data is in that area in the early morning hours and also in a few areas nearby, but then returns to that area.
I missed the 716. Don't know why I did that. Hold on. So we're looking, you have 716, Charles' iPhone is in the area of the True Hilton, so this is AM, correct?
Yeah, so it's, and forgive me, I'm going to use military time because it's what we do, but 0000 is midnight through 716. This animation covers that range of time, and it's playing through what the locations do as one scrolls through that time, including that they end and the True by Hilton. These can be somewhat graphically intensive.
Okay. So as you're continuing through the morning, you continue mapping the GPS of Charles's phone?
Yes, so.
I don't know why it's doing this. Okay.
We may need a different machine.
We May need to what?
A different machine.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.